It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking with one of Wisconsin's members of Congress as he travels part of the state talking with the people that he represents. And we're taking your calls in the short time we have with U.S. Representative Mike Gallagher. What questions do you have for the congressman? What do you think he should prioritize in Washington? 800-642-1234. There's a line for you at that number, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. The Republican congressman represents Green Bay, Appleton, Door County, and other northeastern Wisconsin communities. He was first elected in 2016 and previously served as an intelligence officer for the U.S. Marines. Congressman Mike Gallagher, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
You know, you're traveling around your area talking with constituents. What issues are they bringing up to you?
Well, I'd say the most consistent thing I hear when we visit businesses, whether it's, you know, Wayne's Family Restaurant in Okano or, you know, Expera, well, now Alkstrom Munkstjo is what Expera is called, is how hard it is to find people. I think that's our biggest constraint to economic growth right now. It's businesses want to hire, they want to expand, but they're really having a tough time finding people willing to show up to work or who can pass a drug test. That's a very difficult challenge. And I think more broadly, you know, just talking with individual citizens, I think a lot of people have concerns about their health care costs, right? Health care costs continue to go up and up and up. And I think both parties have kind of approached it in the wrong way in recent years. And we need to sort of reorient our efforts on the issue of transparency in health care pricing so we can get costs to go down.
Yeah, and you introduced legislation earlier this year that requires insurance companies and drug companies, other medical providers, to disclose their prices at the point of purchase. And that would be in print and online. You say that helps the rising healthcare costs. How does that work?
Well, my theory is, and we now have some evidence based on recent studies that that's correct, is once patients have an understanding of where all the money is going, and once patients are allowed to, for example, on their smartphones, start shopping around for care and coverage that, you know, works for them, that it will put pressure on the providers and the insurance companies to not only be more transparent, but also have their costs go down. Because at the end of the day, what is the cost of your insurance, but ultimately a reflection of the underlying cost of care? And so I think that's an area where there's a lot of bipartisan agreement. The Trump administration actually just poured an executive order on the issue of price transparency that I think is a good step forward. But ultimately, it's on Congress to step up and act and require there to be more transparency in the process. Because right now, good luck trying to decipher your medical bill. It might as well be written in a different language. And that complexity, I believe, disadvantages patients and also oftentimes advantages insurance companies and other people that are making money off the current system.
Wisconsin State Representative Amanda Stuck is a Democrat from Appleton. She's already campaigning to challenge you in next year's election. So should we expect health care affordability to be a major focus of this debate like it was in last year's gubernatorial race?
Well, I would hope the issue of health care is one that, you know, every member of Congress or people running takes seriously, just because if for no other reason than we're spending most of our money at the federal level on healthcare. And it's not clear to me that we're getting a better product, right? We've had some troubling trends like life expectancy going down in the last 2 years. And so I certainly think it's an important issue, and it's an issue I hear from a lot of my constituents. But what I would say is it is weird to me that already we're in another election cycle. I feel like I just got reelected, and my real firm hope is that Congress doesn't spend the next year and change merely campaigning, or that everything doesn't get sucked into the vortex of the presidential election, because there's a lot of meaningful things that I think we can do this Congress, whether it's passing USMCA, whether it's passing legislation, speaking of health care, on balance billing, surprise billing, or whether it's injecting transparency into drug prices. I think there's some meaningful steps we can take forward, regardless of who wins in 2020.
I'm Keely Boltina talking with Congressman Mike Gallagher here on The Morning Show. What do you want to ask one of Wisconsin's members of Congress? 800-642-1234. Let's go to Don now, who is in Door County. Don, what do you want to ask the congressman?
Good morning, and thank you, Congressman Gallagher, and thanks to the station. I'm curious as to when you, Mr. Gallagher, are going to hold an open town hall meeting and not surprise me 30 seconds before I'm sitting down to supper and ask me to sit on the phone for a phone-in, call-in town hall meeting. I know, having volunteered for 20 years on town government and state statutory committees, there's a lot of things that people want to ask you, and you are unavailable. When are you going to make yourself available?
Don is looking for more FaceTime with you, Representative Gallagher. What's your response?
My family is as well, so I take your point, Don. I would say this. We have held town halls in every single county in Northeast Wisconsin. We publicized them well in advance. Everyone was invited to come, including in Door County. So I've made myself available to everybody in the district. If you'd like to meet with me personally, Don, would be happy to do that as well. But I would disagree with you on the utility of what's called teletown halls. I actually find them to be very useful because simply, you know, you can reach 100,000 people as opposed to a town hall where only 10 people will show up. And that's one thing we saw with the town halls is towards the end, you know, you'd maybe get 4, 5, 10 people to show up. And so I think really in the modern age, particularly in a district that's as geographically disparate as the one I represent, you have to use multiple fora in order to connect with your constituents. In-person town halls are one of those that I've used, but teletown halls are another very effective tool as well. So apologize for the surprise on that. I don't really know any other way to do it because you really got to take advantage of, you know, when you have an opening to call 100,000 people in the district. But they've been really effective in terms of hearing from people, and I love that. And that's one of the reasons why we're doing this van tour. We're going all over the district. We'll actually be in Door County today. It's really to make sure that my staff, both in D.C. and the district, are here and they're interacting with constituents and hearing from people directly, because that's how we learn, that's how we get better, and that's how we get ideas and take sort of the wisdom and common sense of Northeast Wisconsin and we bring it to the federal level. So, Don, I'm sure I can be doing more. I just try and wake up and improve in this job every single day. So I take your point, and you have my assurances that we will think about, you know, how can we be out there even more. But we have done in-person town halls in every county in the district.
Yeah, and we'll go ahead and link, make sure that there's a link to information if people want to, you know, contact your office directly, Congressman. I do want to ask, recent mass shootings in Dayton, Ohio, and El Paso, Texas, have reignited this national conversation about guns. So what is your opinion on these calls for universal background checks, bans on assault weapons, red flag laws? What proposal can you support to change our nation's gun laws?
Well, I do believe that there's more we can be doing to strengthen the background check process. And I think there's stuff we could do tomorrow. In fact, I actually welcome the idea of canceling the August recess to have a debate about this or any number of other issues that remain unresolved while we take 6 weeks off. I actually think it's absurd for Nancy Pelosi to dismiss Congress for that long when we have so many important issues to debate. I am a co-sponsor of multiple bills to fix the background check process to include something called the 21st Century NICS Act, would basically allow if you get flagged in the system when you apply, when you go through a background check to get a weapon, after 3 days, if nothing comes back, it basically moves forward. It would change that to allow us to tap into a database that we created after 9/11 to ensure that we actually are doing a thorough background check process. I've co-sponsored legislation that would also shift more resources to, and we've actually passed legislation to shift more resources to schools so they can harden themselves. But one thing I would say is if you actually look at recent studies, and there was a recent study that looked at all mass shootings since the 60s, and they tried to identify common trends. One thing that came back was that most mass shooters experience trauma very early in their life. And that's why I've spent so much time focusing on the issue of trauma-informed care.
And Congressman, Gallagher, I'm sorry, we have to leave it there. Hopefully you can join us again. We really appreciate your time today. Republican Congressman Mike Gallagher represents Green Bay, Appleton, Door County, and other northeastern Wisconsin communities. We'll be sure to invite him back. Up next, we're talking about tax dollars here in Wisconsin. I'm Keely Boltina. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Wisconsin raked in more tax dollars last fiscal year than the one before, and numbers for the year ending June 30th show the state collected more than $17 billion in tax revenue. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. We're breaking down this week's data from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau to learn what contributes to an uptick in tax revenue and how much we can read into the increase. Do you think sales tax dollars are a good picture of the economy? Are you happy the state brought in more revenue? Or do you wish those funds had stayed with individuals? 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Logan Kelly is a professor at UW River Falls. He's also chair of the Department of Economics there. Logan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, the state collected nearly $5 billion in sales taxes last fiscal year. What's being taxed when we make purchases in Wisconsin? Where does this money come from?
Well, sales tax essentially is tax for most things that get sold. In general, we throughout the U.S. exclude services from that. But everything from clothes you buy at the store to cars that you buy. And so the measure that you see when you see sales tax revenue gives us a proxy for retail sales.
Yeah.
Now, it's not a perfect proxy, but it does give us that kind of sense of what's going on there.
Yeah. And so what sense do you get then when looking at the latest information in Wisconsin?
Well, I think this story in Wisconsin is very similar to what we see nationally, that in general we have strong fundamentals within the economy with some caveats and some risks going into the future. In particular, we are seeing stronger tax revenue and stronger across the board, including sales tax, which does indicate uptick in economic activity, uptick in purchases, uptick in income. But on the other hand, we have other sectors that have been hit rather hard over the last two to six years, particularly the ag sector.
And it seems, based on sales tax data, that we are buying more. But that doesn't necessarily mean that people who live in Wisconsin are buying more. It means that people who are in Wisconsin are buying more, right? So tourists, people stopping through. I mean, is this data accurately measuring how much we're spending and how much we're being taxed on?
Well, the first answer to your question is no, it's not. That's not what it's intended to do. Sales tax revenue is intended to, and sales tax and taxes in general are intended to collect tax revenue, not necessarily measure economic phenomenon. That's why we have to use that word proxy a lot. And indeed, you're correct. When I look at the incident of sales tax, where it's collected, it has to do with where the transaction takes place. And so if I look at this, say, at the county level, which I have quite often used sales tax as a proxy for kind of economic activity / retail sales at the very local level, you're going to see some differences. If you have a county that has a number of big box stores, you're going to have a higher sales tax revenue than a county that has very few.
Just because of
where the transaction actually takes place. So you're quite correct in saying that, no, it's not necessarily the residents of that particular locality that is doing the spending. It's just that the spending is happening in that locality. Now, it's a little bit of a less of an issue when we start talking bigger regions like the entire state. However, when you live in River Falls, which is very, very close to Minnesota, a lot of the purchasing that happens, we go across the state line to buy in Minnesota. And so that purchasing that's happening by a Wisconsin resident actually is ending up on the tax rolls in the Minnesota sales tax, not the Wisconsin sales tax. So you're right. There is several caveats to the use of sales tax revenue to look at retail sales.
Logan Kelly is chair of the Department of Economics at UW River Falls. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking about sales tax revenue in Wisconsin. What's your take? Is more revenue from taxes good for the state? What do you think of the tax cuts passed by state lawmakers this year? 800-642-1234. Logan, we've heard some leaders say this is an indicator that our economy is strong. Is bringing in more tax dollars, whether that's income tax or sales tax, can we use that to look into the more about really the overall health of the economy?
We can to an extent. We have to be careful. There are a number of measures to look at, particularly when we're talking at state and local level. Tax revenue tax revenue being one of those. In particular, though, we need to look at, we need to not forget about things like the labor market. Also, we have the different sectors within the economy. And if you're asking me what's kind of the interesting thing about the economy, and you have to remember that the economists are like physicians. We get interested in the patient when they're sick, not when they're well. Mm-hmm. The idea is, I don't think right now is as interesting as what might be coming in the future. We've seen several years of harder times within the agricultural sector, and the agricultural sector is still a fairly big component of the state economy. Current national trade policy is not helping that situation, and may well be doing some lasting damage to that situation that doesn't just change when we correct that policy at the national level.
Yeah, we just talked with Congressman Mike Gallagher, who is talking about his part of northern Wisconsin, saying that one of the things he hears from his constituents is they don't have workers. What's the situation with labor supply in Wisconsin?
So that's another significant threat to growth in Wisconsin, is that we have a very, very low unemployment rate right now. And as such, we also have very strong demand for labor. Where the shortcoming is right now in the labor market is labor supply. And so much of the unemployment that we see is what we call structural unemployment. That's unemployment where we have employers who want to hire employees, possible workers who want work, but those workers don't possess the skills that the employers need, and so we have jobs that go unfilled, even though we have unemployed persons who'd be happy to fill those jobs. And so what we end up with is a skills mismatch. And hence, if we're looking at long-run economic development in the state, one of the key things we have to develop is not labor demand, so not trying to generate and create more jobs as much, because we're creating that, we're doing that well, at least at the current time. That can always change, but right now we are. Where we need to be working on is developing our workforce, our labor force.
And last year, Wisconsin officials announced that they will issue sales tax for online purchases. We had a call from Robert in Washburn, too, who says, Robert says that they've noticed that when you buy stuff through the mail or on the internet, more companies are charging Wisconsin sales tax. So how has that change affected the numbers that the state is able to show for revenue?
Well, you see, there's really twofold change there. The first one is, in some sense, it makes that sales tax proxy a little bit better, because we're actually measuring more of the sales that are going in that really, for all intents and purposes, really should have been measured in the first place. So, but it's also another part to that is that's a little reason why it's hard to use sales tax revenue and tax revenue in general as proxies for economic activity, because we have policy changes. And those policy changes will affect what happens in terms of the actual overall collection. And so that's one part of it with respect to the data. But then on the other part, we see the not collecting sales tax on online sales gives online sellers quite a significant advantage. And online sellers who are outside of the state of Wisconsin, quite a significant advantage over sellers located within the state of Wisconsin who are required to collect that Wisconsin sales tax. And so kind of evening the playing field, so to speak, is actually probably quite a good thing for local retailers, even if it does cost us just a little bit more when we click to buy.
Logan, remind us where these tax dollars go. We remit them. What happens to them next?
Well, they go into the state, and then the state goes through its budgeting process. And so one of the things that we should be thinking about is, well, where should the budgeting process go? Particularly in light of the fact that one of the most significant challenges we've got going forward in terms of economic development is developing our labor force. And though this is a little bit self-serving as a person who's been in education all of his career, education is one of those things that needs to be supported and supported more fully. But not just higher ed, the entire range of education, because we do need to develop these skills such that we don't have employers essentially leaving the state or bringing workers into the state in order to fill jobs.
So that the people here in Wisconsin have the skills to fill the jobs that Wisconsin companies are trying to hire for.
Indeed, yes.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you so much for your time giving us a snapshot into what we can really take away from these numbers. Logan, we really appreciate it.
Not a problem. Thank you for having me.
Logan Kelly is a professor and chair of the Department of Economics at UW River Falls. We've been talking about revenue from tax collection here in Wisconsin. And we should note that those dollars, those numbers have not been audited yet. So the money collected, the final data, it could change when that happens sometime in October. Up next is the news, and then we'll hear from a sociology professor who says that the 2020 census is extra important for Americans living in rural areas. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to The Morning Show right here on the Ideas Network. We're exploring how the census is especially crucial for people living in rural parts of the country. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. About 73% of households responded to the last census. Break that down, and it turns out that average is between 75% response in metro counties and 68% response in rural counties. The difference has consequences when it comes to who gets federal funding. Do you participate in the census? How do you think information from the count should affect policies? What are the biggest issues you see in your community? And how could government dollars reallocated make a difference? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. John Green is a professor of sociology, and he's director of the University of Mississippi Center for Population Studies. And he recently wrote a piece for the website The Conversation called Why the 2020 Census Matters for Rural Americans. John, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Let's kind of ground ourselves in this conversation. Can you begin by explaining the purpose of the census?
Sure. The main purpose of the census and the reason why it's mandated in the Constitution is as it relates to counting people for the purpose of political apportionment in the government. And so that's the main, you know, the main reason and the fact that we do it every 10 years. But in addition to that, the census is used for drawing political boundaries at all levels of government, from local government to state and federal. And then also for making determinations for the allocation of government funding for a variety of different programs. And then the census data are also used for all types of information about what we know in terms of where people live, in terms of rural or urban location. It serves as the backbone for data about a variety of different health statistics. And so it's used not only as a primary source, but also as a kind of background set of data for a wide variety of other estimates and projections.
And this is information that's crucial. It's not necessarily if you have more people there, you'll automatically get more funding from the government or something, right? I mean, how does this data shape policy?
Yeah, that's a great question. So obviously, in terms of the numbers, it's important because some funding is allocated on the basis of population counts, but also it's used to determine need. And so for those of us who do work in rural America, for example, we have to, you know, look at how populations are shifting. We have to look at there's a variety of different rural development programs, as an example. And so making sure that we are, you know, accurately conveying the characteristics of those rural places also matters for the access to that type of support for rural development. So it's not just a matter of which places have the highest population, but really trying to understand the characteristics. And then different programs are oriented towards supporting different types of communities.
And is that why you argue that people living in rural areas and small towns have a lot at stake in this next census?
Yes, absolutely. As was mentioned at the beginning of the program, we tend to have lower participation rates in the census from rural areas, and we want to make sure that, you know, given issues of isolation and different challenges that people living in rural America face, that we have as accurate a count as possible, so that when we look at those programs or we look at political representation, all those different ways in which the census data are used, that we have the best count for rural places as possible.
You mentioned isolation as one piece, being far away from services, from other people. Why does participation tend to be lower in rural areas? I assume there are lots of factors.
Yeah, a great number of researchers are, you know, give attention to this, both within the Census Bureau as well as from our universities and different nonprofit organizations who are very focused on making sure that we have a good census count. And there's a wide variety of different factors that are both, personal or family, community context. But in rural places, two of the things that we're very concerned about is the issue of isolation. And, you know, there's different systems in rural America. For example, when we look at the previous participation rates, one of the indicators that we focus attention to is the mail response, how people responded to the mail version of the census, you know, that was sent out. And we know in some rural communities that the mail system works differently, and so we have to, you know, account for that. Additionally, when we think about rural places, it's really the overlay of rural places that may be isolated geographically, but also that have high poverty rates. And for example, my work in Mississippi, in some of our most rural areas, we also have higher poverty rates and a variety of challenges that go along with that. And so when we look at that overlay, that's in particular the places we want to give special attention to.
So we can see how census participation can contribute to economic status in communities. Does it go the other way? Does economic status in communities tell us about who will respond to the census?
That's a great insight, and the answer is yes, to some extent. We know that places that have higher levels of education, areas that have higher median household incomes or lower poverty rates, those types of characteristics, we tend to see higher participation rates. Now, that's not across the board for all communities, but certainly that's the pattern that we identify. And so, you know, one of the things that's happening in a lot of states is using data both from previous censuses as well as what we know now through other contemporary sources like the American Community Survey to identify those places where we think that the counts might be particularly low, that we can go and give additional attention through outreach, education, building. The Census Bureau is using the term trusted voices, which I really like, to say, you know, taking community action to make sure that people participate in the census.
What would you say to people who feel like this sounds like activism? You know, if someone doesn't respond, isn't that their prerogative? Should we really be doing that sort of outreach to get people to participate?
You know, I certainly can understand that perspective, but we have to go back and remember the intent of the census, which is to count all people on American soil. And you know, to the extent that our government, the foundations of our democracy, are based on having that data and informing how our government is shaped, how we make decisions about funding and that sort of thing, that it really is critical that, you know, we live in an information age, and we should be trying to bring as complete a data to government decision-making as possible, as well as for all the other uses of the census that we haven't even talked about, whether it's through businesses, research, what's happening with nonprofit organizations, what's happening through our schools, that we really want to have a commitment, and I think a responsibility to bringing accurate information to that. And, you know, recognizing that in some places there are barriers, that it's not just a matter of personal choice on whether or not somebody participates, but there are barriers, some of which we've talked about, and one that's getting more attention with the upcoming 2020 census is broadband and computer access. This will be the first time that that a majority of Americans, it's hoped, will participate in the census online. And so we want to give even more attention to those places that might have lower computer use, lower broadband access. So that's just an example of one of the barriers that goes beyond just a person's feeling about it, but do they actually have the infrastructure local that makes it easy for them to participate?
John Green is director of the University of Mississippi Center for Population Studies. I'm Keely Boltina, and we want to know, have you ever not filled out your census form? Why did you skip it? Maybe you make sure you and your family are always counted. Why does that matter to you? 800-642-1234. Rural areas often mean close-knit small towns. So is there a way to take advantage of that community aspect to educate people about the census?
Absolutely, I think so. And that's one of the leading efforts that we're doing in Mississippi, but that you see nationwide. As I mentioned, there's all kinds of different challenges locally, and they differ across places. And so to the extent that local communities, local government, businesses, civic organizations can get involved with promoting and educating and doing outreach for the census can make a major difference. The census, you know, hires a large number of people, and they have people who are doing kind of community outreach. They have partnership specialists and a real mobilization effort. But we can't and shouldn't, I would argue, rely on the census alone, that within our states and within our local communities, there are things that can be done. And that's one of the things we've been exploring with partners here in Mississippi is, connecting with communities to get the word out and then saying, here are strategies that you can utilize. And the Census Bureau has a great tool for that. They're called complete count committees. Any local community can organize one. States can also form complete count committees. And people can actually go online to the Census Bureau's website and actually find out if there's a complete count committee in their community. And if not, they can start one. And there's materials for how to do that. And it's just a way to bring people together and organize what's going to be our outreach and education messages in our local community.
Professor John Green stays with us as we're talking about how much the 2020 census matters, especially to Americans living in rural parts of the country. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. There's a line for you to talk about the census. Have you seen the number of people in your part of Wisconsin change? Are you gaining neighbors or are people moving away? And what do you think the census data will reveal about your community? Pick up the phone or email ideas@wpr.org. Our conversation continues ahead here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're having these discussions right here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. Much of the news lately about the census has centered on a question about citizenship and whether including something like that would discourage people from responding. Our guest says people in rural areas, too, should consider how critical an accurate census is to their part of America. Do you live in a small town or out in the country? What are the biggest issues you see in your community? 800-642-1234. Share your thoughts. Let us know if you think people underestimate the importance of the census or if you don't see what the big deal is. Email ideas@wpr.org. Let's take a call now. Tom from Burlington has a question about how the census can help us understand an accurate count. Tom, what are you out wondering this morning?
Well, this is a very important thing, in my opinion, especially in rural areas in Wisconsin. We lost a congressman the last go-around in the census, and Texas picked up 4 congressmen, I believe. Now, that they control Washington, D.C., and they also control our textbooks. Texas makes us, they tell us what kind of textbooks we're supposed to have. Now, we are the undocumented citizens, people are allowed, they're counted, but and these numbers go up, but they can't vote. And it seems like a lopsided thing. We're in some kind of a catch-22 situation here.
I got you, Tom. Yeah. Let's talk about that. John, why is the census designed not to count voters, but to count all of the people living in a particular part of the country?
Very important question. As I mentioned earlier, one of the main purposes is to have a accurate reflection of the population. And of course, one purpose, you know, of that's been mentioned is the issue of allocation. And certainly there is a perspective that should focus on voters. But what we have to remember is that the government serves the population of an area. And so when it comes to the resources that are needed, when it comes to the economic activity, when it comes to what it takes to serve a community, all of those factors go in beyond just the voting population. Now, this is definitely an issue that has, you know, caused a great deal of controversy and debate since the founding and since the first census in 1790. And you can imagine at different eras in American history where we've tried to address this issue. What's interesting, and I will point out, is that we do collect data about citizenship, not through the census. The American Community Survey, which was started in the mid-2000s and is officially related to our you know, government counts for all the different things for government spending and so forth that I mentioned, that it does include a citizenship question. And so, you know, the idea is that if you have that on the census form itself, that it can have an impact on who participates, and then we don't have an accurate count. And that's the concern, and that's what the debate is about.
Yeah. Beyond that documentation, though, some people are innately skeptical of the census. You received a comment on your article because someone thought the census was essentially a marketing research for business and industry. So how do we counter this idea, or is there any merit there?
I think it is important to take those concerns and those perspectives very seriously. And one of the main things that both the Census Bureau is trying to do, but others working in organizations such as myself, our Center for Population Studies houses the State Data Center from Mississippi, and there's a State Data Center in every state around the country. And part of what we're trying to do is to help get out the message of what the census is, what it contains, what accurate information on what it's going to ask, and what are the main purposes. So it is true that the public, and that includes you know, everyday citizens, to businesses, to researchers, have access to aggregated census data, and it can be used for a wide variety of business decisions. But the main purpose, again, is as it relates to running the government, and then also not just our political representation, but also our allocation of resources, and you know, the usefulness for planning what's needed in terms of infrastructures and services. And so, you know, we are committed through the state data centers for public access to publicly paid for data. And that includes a wide variety of users. But there are a lot of protections that are in place, and the confidentiality is something that's taken very seriously.
John Green is director of the University of Mississippi Center for Population Studies. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking about how important the census is, especially in rural communities. What are your thoughts? 800-642-1234. John, I don't want to let this point go. Kenneth from Janesville couldn't stay with us, but he is wondering about how our privacy is protected in the census. Talked about that data being aggregated, so in big form, big numbers with information stripped from it. But how do we know that the information we're handing over in the census, you know, remains confidential?
The Census Bureau takes that very seriously to the extent that there's actually penalties that include both jail time and monetary funds for people who are working within the census system who would commit any kind of violation. And that's just to emphasize right up front how important this is taken. There's titles under the U.S. Code that protect and prevent the release of identifiable information about individuals, households, businesses, even protecting that that we cannot release that information, or the Census Bureau cannot release that information, even to law enforcement agencies. So it's a very strict set of guidelines, and people can actually go to the Census website and find out that information. There's actually a flyer called the 2020 Census and Confidentiality that outlines what the protections are and what are the codes that protect people's information.
You know, we've heard a lot about population loss in rural areas in recent years, and we wonder how census data can help us better understand the scope of that.
This is, I think, one of the most critical questions that we need to be able to address as it relates to planning and what types of services and infrastructure are needed, as I previously mentioned. There are a lot of different sources of information that we can use to try to estimate what the population is, how it's changing, and so forth. But among all of those tools that we have to use, the census is the bedrock to those data that we compare to and that we look at how they change across time. And if we're concerned about population loss, especially due to, for example, out-migration from rural communities, then we need to be very attentive to the accuracy of those data. We don't want to be, trying to use solutions through community economic development, state policies, federal programs that don't match the needs of a local community. And so having those accurate census data are going to allow us to tailor what approaches we're doing to help communities, thrive and sustain over time.
What are the consequences if rural America doesn't show up for the census?
Well, one issue that has been brought up is as it relates to political representation. That's very important. Places that have, rural populations, if we have an undercount, that affects their political representation. It affects their voice in the political system, and like we said, at various levels, not just nationally, but even within our individual states. And then I think the other issue is that if we're not counted, then the types of resources that might be needed are not going to go to those places. And so as I mentioned, it's not just a matter of how many people, but certainly we have to demonstrate that there are people in rural communities, and that information should be used for making these decisions for allocations of dollars.
John, thank you so much for this conversation.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
John Green is a professor of sociology. He's also director of the University of Mississippi Center for Population Studies. We've been talking about the role of the census. I'm Keeley Boltina. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.